Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vaslash and John McElroy, episode 365 for February 17th, 2017. Adient, the inside story. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
Mr. Vaslash.
Here we are, back in the studio.
Oh, God, I love being in the studio.
Yeah.
I do. It was nice to go to Chicago last week. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
But...
So for all of you who didn't watch it last week, just watch the replay on the YouTube channel and see us in Chicago.
Yeah, or on the website.
On the website.
Okay, we got to let everybody know. Todd Lassa, Automobile Magazine, back in the house with us again.
Always good to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. And our special guest today is Tom Gould. He's the Director of Design, Research, and Craftsmanship at Adient, which is a brand new supplier company, or actually an old supplier company with a brand new name.
It is, and it's a really nice place to be right now. So we feel like a startup with all this history and experience. So it works out great for us.
And the company was?
Johnson Controls. So.
And you've got the seating business, right?
We do the seating business, right? So we still have a partnership with Yunfeng Automotive. So
Yunfeng, we should mention, has what, the rest of the interior stuff?
Part, correct.
And that was spun out of JCI as well.
It was, yeah. One family kind of.
So for those who are not aware of it, so when you say that they have the other parts of the interior, so you guys have the seats.
We do seats.
And then they have the trim, which would be?
Door panels, instrument panels, floor consoles, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I actually grew up in that part of the organization and moved into the seat side, so.
So you're a veteran of the interior of an automobile.
Yes, I've spent my entire career working on what goes inside.
So how does a designer become an interior guy?
Honestly, it's a little bit of an interesting path you take. So there's a lot of the folks who enter design who are really about the exterior, the other parts. When you look at the interior, there's this kind of mix of what the exterior designers do in terms of form development and creating a language for what that product is, and a product design approach. So, and really, when we look at our seats, it's a very different approach for each different product. But it starts with a design challenge and a problem statement.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. When we go to new product presentations, see a new car, typically the company, whatever it is, foreign, domestic, will roll out the exterior designer and then bring us the interior designer, and he or she will explain everything, you know, why they did certain things on the interior. Can you in any way quantify how much of their work is your work? That is, among the average auto... at an average automaker, among all automakers, do you do, say, 50% of the design work? Do you do more than that?
Our role is really to make sure that whatever the vision is that's set by our customers for where their vehicle needs to go is coming out through those products.
Okay.
And sometimes we need people that have a level of expertise that can deliver on that. So I want to make sure that if we do something for our customer, when we put a hand-built seat in front of them to buy off on that, that's what's going to look like when it's rolling down the line. So, but we do everything. We, from the earliest sketches to following through the plants to make sure that we're delivering what we need to. And every customer is going to be a little different in terms of how they want to engage with us.
I imagine most people are not even aware that a lot of suppliers have their own design studios and design staffs. How do you work with the OEMs? I mean, do you bring ideas to them? Do they say, here's our theme, make it so, or what?
For us to be a good supplier, we should be doing that all the time. It's not just
you mean about bringing them ideas.
Bringing them the ideas, yes. So when we have we just had our auto show, and a big part of that is really talking about, okay, how do we think? When you come to Adient, what is it that we can add to what you're doing that's going to make you more successful? So it's everything. That's why research is a part of what I do. It's the design, and that's taking that research and fleshing it out through a product proposal, and even at the craftsmanship level, making sure that we're delivering on all those things as you go through. So for, and again, every customer is going to be different in terms of what they want from us. As an industry, it's a lot of the suppliers have design groups, and we all kind of know each other, and because it's pretty small. But it is interesting because we all have a similar approach to the world and how we see things. So even though we're competing out there in the business stand from a business standpoint, we're looking at the world from through the same eyes.
Mm-hmm. So when you're developing a seat, how much of the development is concentrating primarily on the aesthetic versus how much is the ergonomic aspect of the product?
So comfort is an aesthetic, right? And a comfortable seat is going to be an attractor for you. A seat that is just has the absence of discomfort is the bare minimum you can have. But to answer your question, every seat has to fit within the environment, and keeping in mind that the seat is made out of different stuff than the rest of the car. So the rest of the car is made out of a lot of hard parts and that sort of thing, and the seat is a softer part that's meant to, you know, cradle you and keep you safe and comfortable while you're going down the road. So for us, we want to make sure that you get both. So it's the form and function going hand in hand to make sure that the consumer, that all of us get what we want when we look at that car.
So is there a balance with the form and function, or does one sometimes...
So safety is always the primary concern, right? No matter, we are never going to do something that is unsafe. The comfort is right up there with it, because that's got to be there, and then the trade-off process is, okay, how can we get the vision of what the seat is meant to look like so it communicates the brand along with the rest of the interior to work with the to work with the full car and with the criteria set out in safety, comfort, etc.
Mm-hmm. Is the safety of the seat governed by any kind of governmental regulations? And obviously, the answer is yes, but I mean, how much of that is? I mean, is that a big stack, a big book?
Yes, it is. So within our organization, we have subject matter technical experts. They make sure that all of the requirements are being built into the seats, but they also make sure that all that kind of tribal knowledge that we have as a supplier is also being leveraged as we design the new generation of seats. So. And as we know, we're moving into some very interesting times in our industry. And so these things are going to start to change, and we're going to be challenged more than we ever have in terms of what a seat is going to be for us as consumers and what it does.
Are there any new standards coming up in the next few years that you are working hard to try to meet? Anything? I mean, for example, on the car, we've got a roof crush standard that's getting more and more strict by the day. We've got, of course, on the fuel economy side, potentially the 2025 CAFE. Anything monumental like that in terms of seat safety?
Not that's right on the immediate horizon in terms of requirements, but at least those that I'm aware of that my team is working with. But those things are always changing. And as we look at a future where the self-driving cars are becoming a bigger part of that story, and we get to do things that are a little different, we may need to take a longer look at some of those requirements. So there's requirements for unbelted occupants and that sort of thing that we need that can prevent us from actually doing certain things within the vehicle. We've shown things in our auto shows before that you can do this in Europe or China or Asia, but you can't do it here, and in other requirements where, you know, things are reversed. But how do we do that when we talk about long tracks and pivots and those sorts of things? So you're talking about motions that aren't necessarily a part of our general vocabulary today that are going to be a bigger part of where things go. So those will all require more oversight and some rules that we'll have to make sure that everyone follows, that people remain safe in their cars.
So what are some of the aesthetics things that you're looking at? And I ask because at the Detroit Auto Show, Nissan showed the QX50 concept,
yes,
but it's pretty damn near production. And one of the things that the head designer, Alfonso Albaiza, was very proud of is that they created a quilted seat look without getting into the complex stitching that you need for quilting. They figured out some very simple stitch that gave you the look, but was a whole lot cheaper.
Right.
What kind of things are you guys working on along those lines?
There's quite a bit, because if you look at what a lot of our customers are wanting to do, you know, concave seats are, you know, our backs and legs are convex, so they need a concave surface to sit in. So we're looking at all sorts of different technologies that can deliver a convex surface on a seat without bridging. So when you make things out of leather, as you know, they can get wrinkly and baggy if you don't control that. So that's why seats are shaped the way they are. That's where bolsters came from in the beginning, was really trying to start to mimic what a convex shape would be. But the reality is you're kind of undulating shapes. Now we need things that are going to deliver that concave, and we have a lot of technologies that'll do that for us today.
Okay, the seat's concave. Now, how do I just slide in and out?
There's a variety of ways. It all depends on your path, your entry egress path. So if you're talking about a pickup truck, obviously you're getting up into that. If you're talking about certain sedans, you're getting down into it. So each seat has to kind of fulfill its requirement, not just when you're sitting in it, but for entry egress. A seat is a seat when a human is sitting in it, but it also has to figure out how to get out of your way when you're getting in and out of the car. It has to figure out how to be a receptacle for whatever you're bringing into the car. So it has to fold flat, has to do all these things, keep you safe. So there's a lot to it. Normally we just get in the car and just go. If the seat is not bothering you, it's covered some of the ground that it needs to. But it needs to do that.
If they want concave seats, sounds like automakers want seats that are snugger, maybe, than they are today.
A little snugger, but really just how do you match the... If you start with us as a human and as your problem statement, and what are our needs from a comfort and safety standpoint, you're going to actually create a seat that's going to be a little different. So those are some of the things we work on in our kind of skunkworks side of our business. Just recreating the problem statement. A lot of seats are just built up from a collection of parts that we know we can put all these things together and get something that's an automotive seat. But from a design standpoint and an advanced engineering standpoint, we want to understand what's happening with the human body, what we as consumers are doing in the car. We have a fairly large consumer research and market research team, and they also go out and look at all the advanced trends and things that are happening in the world. So things like more people living in cities, ride-sharing becoming a bigger part of our future, and what happens when cars are driving themselves, the connectivity. And what gets really interesting is when you start overlaying a lot of these different trends, you get these really strong problem statements that you need to design around to develop the next generation of vehicles and the seats that go in them. Hopefully that answers.
So you guys are a global supplier, so your seats are all over the world in different... Okay, is there such a thing as an American seat, a German seat,
yes,
Japanese seat?
Absolutely. We all have... there's different tastes and there's different driving styles. So I was in Germany last week, and there's a very controlled process of, you know, going down the Autobahn, and everything is fairly orderly. The seats there, and things are getting a little homogenized as the world kind of gets smaller. But in the past, seats in Europe have been firmer, right? They support you on a longer drive. In the United States, we've always had the more showroom comfort has been kind of the way we described it, but softer seats. Those have blended a little bit, and we've adjusted our technologies to make sure that that blend happens in the right way and it's meaningful. So we have a comfort lab that's constantly looking at what do we need to do for consumers in terms of comfort. And, I mean, we're all different sizes and different shapes and have different needs, and how does that all work within the foam formulations, how we put the foam together, if it's foam at all, because that's something that we could be seeing differences in the future. And then Japan and China have been a little different, but even physiologically, people are different in different parts of the world, and we have to understand how that happens. So what might be an acceptable lumbar here in the United States, you go to China and they're like, this is horrible. So understanding what people need is very important as how we start the design process. Mm-hmm. So
very interesting. And we're going to have to talk a whole lot more about it. But right now, we got to take a quick break. We're going to give a shout out to our friends from Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Hey, we got a question here from Yogesh Agrawal. I hope I said that right, who sent this in via Twitter. Question for Tom. What will be the new challenge to designing very low-weight seating systems with good craftsmanship?
The craftsmanship typically isn't the challenge we have. What we find when we do lightweight seats, it has to do with the material selection and making sure that everything we do is going to meet the current requirements, but also meet the cost requirements, because you and I have to afford these cars. So we do things where we have different projects where we're looking into composites, and we can lightweight quite a bit with composites. The other things we've done is look at how do we make seats much thinner. If I can take an inch out of a front and rear row, not only does that make that seat a little lighter, if I work closer with the automaker in the beginning, we can take those 2 inches out of the vehicle itself. The consumer loses nothing in terms of space.
Make the whole vehicle two inches smaller.
So if you take that slice out, then you're talking about some more significant weight saves beyond what the seat is doing. But the one thing we found when we study what consumers are looking for in a seat is that if you go too thin, people will automatically look at it and say, it doesn't look comfortable, it doesn't look safe. Even though it's just as safe and comfortable as the next seat, we're very comfortable with the things we know. Mm-hmm. And that's a hurdle we have to get over. And that's why some of the opportunities we have with vehicles where early adopters are a big part of that segment, that's where you go with your ideas to try to kind of bring those into the spotlight.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, we've seen thin seats in concept cars at auto shows for years, and I think we've a few models. I think they've thinned the model a little bit in the current Ford Mustang, for example, mm-hmm. I believe, and maybe a couple of others, not off the top of my head though. So, what's it going to take? So, you think it's mostly just it's both cost and consumer perception of this?
As some of these materials become more prevalent, scale will help bring some of the cost down. But there's a threshold, too. So some of these things will, I mean, every time we get close with composites, steel technology just keeps itself ahead. So in terms of cost and doing what it needs to do to keep us safe in the vehicles. So.
And I'd like to ask a viewer question for my wife, who will be watching this on tape. So, and this is a big deal to Donna from Ferndale. Would like to know, because she gets into all these press cars I drive. Mm-hmm. Only she's basically usually in the front passenger seat.
Okay.
She judges the car first about whether or not. Well, she likes sports cars with stick shifts first, but. The next thing for her is, does the front passenger seat have lumbar support control? And very few cars do, even luxury cars. You find, a certain set like Mercedes and even GM vehicles for some reason. They have it in some Fiat Chryslers, but not all. What determines whether that front passenger seat gets a feature like that?
It tends to be the marketing team at the OEM will kind of work out what the feature set needs to be for that vehicle, and they've done a lot of research to say, okay, what they're making the trade-offs too, right? So what is what's going to keep the car in the cost range we need it to be to keep it successful, but still give people what they want? And honestly, you go out there and look at some of the cars that are on the road today, and you are getting a lot for your money for the compared to where things were even just a few years ago. And there's a lot in those. So there's been a real effort on the side of our customers and the supply base to keep looking for those solutions that are going to keep the cost down.
True, but conversely, when you get into a luxury car, $60,000, $70,000, even an $80,000 car, and there's not that control on the front passenger seat, is that just are the marketing people overlooking it, or is it still a cost issue?
A lot of the honestly, a lot of the seats we work on have lumbar control on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's becoming more common.
I think it is becoming more common again because we've figured out how to make those more cost effective, and drive those in at different levels. I mean, we're even seeing a proliferation into the rear row of some of the typical front row seat sets.
Heated rear seats is becoming, slide fore and aft rear seats. Even.
Yes. And cloth seats with heat was something you'd never run into in the past, and those are becoming more prevalent out there. And, those of us who live in a place like Michigan appreciate that.
Yeah, we do.
One of the greatest inventions in the world.
So, Tom, one of the things that you guys do, which I've always found surprising, is that, you mentioned in passing that, that you guys do some research. Well, everybody does research, but you guys do some serious ethnographic research that goes deep. And the other thing that you guys do, which surprised me, which sort of, I think, hooks onto the end of that, is you do, concept vehicle bucks with what you've learned. Can you talk to us about what you guys are up to there?
Yeah, there's always first gathering the data, and there's so much data out there, and how do you distill that down into an insight that says, here's where we need to focus our energies. But even with that, there's a lot of different ways to answer certain questions. So we'll go out and do primary research with consumers. We'll talk to people, and they will not be able to tell you what they really need. But if you learn about them and how they live and what they're doing, you start to gain some. You'll spot things. Okay, here's some opportunities for us. And once we take those and we can put together a persona. Who is this person who will be driving this car? What do they need in their life? Then you can start forming some of those seat concepts around that. So we'll use we call them demonstrators. They're more or less show properties, but we want to show our customers things that they can really have. Just showing them vision properties tells them that we're out there and leading. We want to lead the industry in how we think, but at the same time, they need to know that the things we're thinking about are things that will work for them. So what we did at the auto show this year, we developed called the AI-17, and that was focused around the trends that we're seeing in terms of luxury vehicles, but also self-driving cars. So the seats will pivot out of the car to meet you. So as you come up, you can use an app that car knows you're coming, opens the door. You get in the seat that's pivoted out to you. There's a little puddle light, and it pivots you back into a driving position if you're going to drive. The seats can also pivot inboard so that if you want to have a conversation with the person next to you, it makes that a little easier. They can go into a deep recline where, the body is supported evenly throughout the throughout the seating position, and honestly, when I'm working at these auto shows for 12 hours.
Here we go, running.
12
so
hours a day.
You design interior design. You must love this move to autonomy.
So, for us, it really raises the level of importance of what we are going to get as consumers out of the interior. It's going to force us to do things a little differently, and when you couple the share car with autonomous driving, you're getting this really interesting overlay of what could happen for us. So the level of specific features is going to continue to increase. So those kind of customized solutions that we all want our personalized vehicle, but if we don't own it, what does that mean to us? Well, what it would mean to us is like when I dial up my app for this car to come get me, I'm going to be making certain choices based on what's going on in that interior. If it's just a flat seat I just need to sit on just to get to somewhere in 5 minutes, I probably don't care. If I'm going to spend more time, it'll be a bigger deal.
We've got a bunch of questions here from the audience. We're getting down to the end. Why don't we do this real rapid fire?
Sure.
So Mike from San Francisco says, you probably can't tell us, but when are we going to see those pivoting seats?
We could be ready with those in about 3 years. There will be a pivoting seat, I think, in Europe even sooner.
And this is for the driver and the front, but to get in and out of the car.
Yeah, or just make adjustments in certain types of vehicles. What we're really focused on now is, okay, now that we can offer consumers different ways to sit in a car, how do we make sure they're safe? So if I'm sitting at a 15-degree angle, if I'm reclined very, very far back, you know, there's a submarining requirement to make sure you don't go shooting out the window if something happens. All those things are of paramount importance when we're trying to develop those seats.
Okay, we got two very similar ones. Wright Knight and Atlabama want to know about bench seats. Did they go away due to regulations or nobody wanted them?
More or less because nobody wanted them, but there are, you can still get...
In trucks, right?
Trucks, you can still get bench seats, yes.
Okay. Do you always know what this is from Armand. Do you always know what the final product will look like? If not, are you disappointed when stuff gets into production? You go,
That's a tough one because what we can set as a vision for a product in the beginning and those very early sketches that you get excited about can be more expressive than sometimes what you can really realize in the real world. However, you grow to appreciate the fact that when I go through an auto show and I look at something that hit production and I say they did it, they pulled it off, that's like a huge sense of accomplishment for that design team to say we did it. So it may not be as flashy and flamboyant, but it really shows the strength of a design team that can pull off.
Guest KW wants to know, how come all sport and sporty cars have black interiors?
It just becomes a preference. You know, it's all sedans are all gray, right? I thought 50 Shades of Gray was something about car interiors when I first heard it.
Abby from Canada says, I've seen so many concept seats at auto shows throughout the decades, but they're still not in production. When are we going to see a new look for interior seat design?
There's been a lot of things that have been shown in concept cars that if you actually crashed in those, you'd probably not have a good day. But we're working towards those certain things, and if you take all of the requirements a seat has to meet along with the cost requirements, you kind of understand why things haven't changed a whole lot. But all that said, I think we're on the cusp of some big changes in the interior of vehicles, because as consumers, we're going to be focused on different things. Right now, we're worried about making sure we're going down the road and driving safely. As soon as I can let go of that wheel, my concerns are going to shift. I'm going to be more cognizant of things that might be making me uncomfortable, and everything from, you know, pressure to thermal comfort. You know, am I getting a little too warm? You get very aware of those things very quickly as soon as you get to direct your attention back to yourself. So it'll happen soon.
Yeah. If I could follow up on that, any new materials coming on board? Seat cover, seat surface materials. Is leather here to stay? What's going to be in the middle or the commodity market too?
So leather is here to stay, right? It's really hard for us to get out of the mindset that leather is that premium interior material for a car. Yeah. However, it's probably one of the worst things you can ever make a seat out of.
Yeah. And there are so many different kind of grades, you know, of leather.
You know. There is, and that you can get a very good leather and still struggle to trim a seat. And so it's always a back and forth trying to make sure that the trim is going to match the rest of the contours of the seat so you don't get wrinkling and bagginess and your seat looking bad after a little while. We're seeing more trends towards premium fabrics.
Good. I love fabric.
Fabrics are great, and I think this is coming. You know, you look at the handbag industry, and that's kind of maybe leading the way a little bit, but premium fabrics will be a bigger deal, and we'll see kind of what region those take off in first. So
one last question here from Jonathan Brown, who obviously has a Corvette. He wants to know, on the driver's seat, on the left side bolsters, back and side, is anybody looking at something where the bolsters would, like, go down into the seat for easy egress and ingress and then pop back up to hold you snugly? Because in a Corvette, as you know, the way it's positioned with the rocker panel, you couldn't pivot the seat, I don't believe.
Right, yeah. That's a whole nother – the pivoting in a confined space is a whole nother issue. But there's plenty of concepts out there. We know how to make those. It's just whether they're that's the right cost to put those into the vehicles. But for us to do it. There are seats with bladders in them that actually will adjust the comfort for you. There's more mechanical solutions. There's some things we did in our the demonstrator that I talked about a minute ago that really allow you to kind of control the contours. There's a natural control surface there that doesn't require you to do anything for the seat to really cradle you. But at the same time, we can go in and actually make mechanical tweaks.
Yeah, because I'm sure we've all driven, S-Class Mercedes, 7 Series BMW, where when you turn the wheel,
right,
one side or the other side of the seat will snug you up.
Yeah.
And it's great for cornering.
Speaking of which, another question my wife will want me to ask is...
Donna from Ferndale.
Donna from Ferndale would like to know when massaging seats are going to make their way into mainstream cars. Is that very expensive, and we're not going to see that outside of Mercedes and luxury brands for a while?
Again, back to the self-driving cars, I think those may be one of those things that actually help usher in more... And if you think about a situation where, again, I don't own. You know, I may have called it up from a service, and it shows up to pick me up. And while I'm going down the road, I may decide I need a massage. So I just plug it in my app. I paid a couple bucks, and I get a massage while I go down the road. So I mean, a lot of the things that we're looking at in this new wave of the automotive industry have a lot less to do with the car itself and more to do with the services that can be offered.
Mm-hmm. Is that an exceptionally costly feature, though?
I wouldn't say so, but it would, if you're doing a value analysis team trying to get the cost down on the mid-cycle enhancement, it might be one of those first things that go.
When it comes to 10 cents per half million cars sold.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And nobody's looking to put more weight in the vehicle either, so those are a little, again, there's a balancing act.
Yeah. So.
Very interesting. Tom, thanks so much for coming on AutoLine After Hours. It's been great talking with you. Great to get this insight of how suppliers work with automakers and where seats are going.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on today.
Thanks. We're going to take a quick break, folks, and we'll be right back.
There's only one talk show that covers the issues and executives that drive the auto industry. Turn to AutoLine This Week, every Friday at AutoLine.tv or on your local PBS stations across America. AutoLine This Week. You can't get more inside the industry.
Seats are so complicated. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing. And they've got to be one of the most important parts of a car, only because your butt's in one every single second that you're in a car.
Well, and, it kind of started, Volkswagen got a lot of credit 15 or 20 years ago, first Audi and then Volkswagen for improving the interiors, which is where most owners spend their time with a car, is, behind the wheel or in one of the passenger seats. And so it just seems there's been this acceleration in, getting nicer seats, nicer interiors in even commodity cars, Chevys and Toyotas and Fords and so on, for years now. So
it almost seems like this is, the blinding flash of the obvious. It's just like for so many years it's been about, the exterior, because that's going to get him in the showroom to look at the car.
Right.
And that looks sweet, and they get in the thing and it's like, oh, this feels, and then they drive it home. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, and then when you think of American cars from the 50s and 60s, they were so colorful. They had some, especially in the 1950s, they had these two or three or four tone interiors, mm-hmm, and some really different kind of patterns and so on and so forth. And they were very exuberant. But then we went into that period where, by the late 60s, early 70s, the Germans were starting to invade, and then the Japanese. And Germans were known for, Spartan interiors, for very straightforward, hard seats and black and gray interiors and so on. Whether that's deserved or not, that seemed to kind of identify them. And you had Volvos with very safe interiors, and they even had tried the seats with no insert. Remember those, mm-hmm, for a few years?
What do you mean, 70s? No insert?
They were basically a frame, and they had a big hole where you put your back. Remember those?
I don't.
Gary, you remember. There were
sections taken out of them.
Sections out of them.
I remember in the headrest, you know, there'd be sort of an outline, you know, nothing in the middle. But I don't remember seats.
I thought, you know, maybe you're thinking concept car.
Then we had that Continental in here a couple of weeks ago that had, what was it, a 30-way, 38-way?
Yeah, or 36-way.
Some crazy adjustable thing. But, I thought Tom said something very interesting, I thought, in passing when, you know, we were talking about seat designs, like maybe a seat with these cutouts sort of thing, that, you know, people have certain expectations of what a car seat should look like, you know, because, you know, as you know, we've all said, you know, you see these concept car seats, it's like, wow, those look so cool. How come when you go into a dealership or get a new vehicle, they all pretty much look like seats, right? I mean, they don't have any of these really exotic forms. And, you know, it's about customer expectation. And so I wonder, is it going to take new car companies, okay, like
like Tesla, or is obviously what you're thinking.
Yeah, I mean something like that. The person who's buying that is not coming with the same expectations that someone has when they're going to buy a Malibu. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so you would be able to have something that looks like an Aeron chair.
Well, and which would be nice, but the feature I dislike most on the Tesla Model S, and I think it's a good car overall, but the fact that they just made the center screen so much bigger than everybody else's, I think that's just adding to the distraction. And, you know, a computer on wheels is what you're buying, not a car.
Right.
That bothers me a little bit. But on the other hand, fascinating to hear that there's some kind of resistance toward the thin seats because... For me, you know, our generation grew up watching the Jetsons. You're waiting for the flying cars. Well, I never was waiting for flying cars. I just wanted thin seats. I thought they looked good and they looked comfortable and they looked stylish, too. And then think about, you know, how much room you would save in a two-seat sports car with thin seats, let alone a car with a back seat where you gain that interior space without having to extend the wheelbase or widen the car.
So what are you going to get for a flying car or thin seat?
If you want to fly the car, I think that's a disaster waiting to happen. I don't know. Maybe if you get them to fly themselves. So an autonomous flying car might work, but sounds like the skies are going to be very crowded. Mm-hmm. You'll be crashing into a lot of
Amazon drones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's that part of the program where we have to go to the Dr. Data segment.
All right, so this is I thought this was a rather interesting thing that I discovered this week. And so, Carmen, could you please bring up the bar chart? Okay. Well, I thought we had the bar chart. Okay, we don't have the bar. Oh, there we go. Here, the bar chart. Okay, so this is obviously the growth of something from 2012 to 2016. Uh-huh. And notice the 2012-2016 nearly doubling. Mm-hmm. So what could this be?
In millions SUV sales?
This is millions. Here are the numbers. So this is millions, yes.
Yeah. But not SUV sales.
Not SUV sales.
Well, certain segments.
Yes.
Crossover. No. Could it be crossover? Let me just think about it.
Well, that would, how do you break that out?
We got to get one of those clocks that goes do, do.
Yeah.
Do, do, do,
yeah.
Do. Yeah.
Okay, you stumped me, Gary.
All right, Carmen. The answer, please.
Oh, hybrid sales.
So global hybrid sales. And so, you know, isn't it striking that, you know, in the last 5 years, now when we would think, 4 years, that they would not be doing as well, that, you know, you suddenly get this growth.
Yeah.
And so I would have thought cheap gas would have and bringing it down.
Well,
the other
again,
direction.
But this is global.
Right.
And, you know, Toyota is really getting going with hybrids in Europe. Mm-hmm. I'll bet you if you broke it out by region, Toyota's greatest growth has been
for
hybrids.
Taking sales from diesels. And in the U.S. even, if you look at Prius sales, now there was a bit of a spike in Prius sales when they added different body style or models to the Prius
that was
lineup.
About 5 years ago.
That was about 5 years ago, and now it's back down to, I think it's one and a quarter or 150 a year.
The Prius's sales are sinking fast. They've been in a free fall for, I'm going to say, almost 3 years now.
But then on top of it, you also have, a hybrid Camry available.
Oh, yeah, and far more hybrid
and
models.
Actually, and I've argued, I went on an early drive of the Prius Prime, the plug-in version, last year, and argued in my review that this should really be the standard for Prius at this point. Mm-hmm. Forget the conventional hybrid, and I think there was even a story this week about maybe Toyota heading in that direction.
Yeah, but what's the... you're looking at some numbers there,
Well,
Gary?
So 136,629 sales of Prius last year.
Yes. So it's a good number, how much?
Well, from the year before, it was 185,000. So, I mean, they lost 50,000.
So a big drop with an all-new model. That's not supposed to happen.
The all-new model also ended, forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but didn't they end production of the other sub-models,
The C?
The C, and then there's the...
They had the C last year. It was the C and the V.
Yeah.
They
dropped them because they weren't selling.
Right, exactly.
I was...
So the number now is back down to where Prius was when it was just one body style.
No, I don't... Well, yeah, if you go
not when it first launched, when people were paying, $5,000 over sticker for them.
But the new Prius, from a performance standpoint, fuel economy standpoint, is a much better car.
Yeah,
right.
It's the sales are way down. Hmm.
But I thought it was interesting. So this week I was out driving the new Hyundai Ioniq hybrid
and
plug-in and EV. Now I can't tell you about driving these things.
Sure,
but I thought it was very interesting that, one of the things that these guys are doing is they're really making the cars affordable in a way that hybrids have historically not been so affordable. You've always been basically paying a premium. And, I mean, it's astonishing. So the starting MSRP for a just straight hybrid, not the plug-in, is $22,200.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah. Excluding destination. So it's over $23,000.
Yeah, but I mean...
Yeah. Now, that's a hell of a price.
It's a conventional compact car.
Remember, the Honda Insight was I want to say it was a sub-$20,000 car when it first came out.
But it was also not, it was by far the inferior car in the
Totally
hybrid
agree.
Class.
But I'm just saying.
It wasn't a full, it didn't get great.
It wasn't a very good car.
Right.
It wasn't a very good car.
The CRZ, which used the same powertrain, got poorer mileage than the old CRXs, 30 years ago.
But I'm just saying, just because you have a cheap price doesn't mean they're going to fit to the car.
But there's something else going on here, I would argue, and that's that it's more like mainstreaming the powertrain so that you're not, Prius, you bought the car because you wanted to show off that you were being green, that you were saving fuel and driving a cleaner car. Now, basically, automakers like Toyota and so forth need to develop these for their mainstream cars to meet 2025 CAFE, assuming that standard still goes forth. But even if it doesn't, even if we get some version of that or some delay, increased fuel mileage, you're going to need that, including in those sport utility vehicles.
Well, as they pointed out, the ZEV states are going to still be ZEV states, and you're still going to... So that's, a good chunk of cars. That's going to be helpful in that regard.
Population, sure.
Remember last summer we did the show with Marianne Wright from what is still JCI, and she was talking about these 48-volt hybrids, and now everyone's talking about them because if I remember what she said, you can get 80% of the fuel economy benefit of a strong hybrid like a Prius. So you can get 80% of the way towards a Prius for 20% of the cost. So I think... Everything's going to go 48 volts.
Oh, yeah. That shouldn't take too long, one would think. I just came here from the Chevrolet Cruze diesel presentation in downtown Detroit. So that's kind of the yang to the hybrid yin. And
what do you think?
Well, I mean, there's still... it wasn't a drive. It was just...
overall, what do you think, Ed?
I don't know. I think it's still going to be a niche for them because I think diesels in the U.S. make more sense in trucks and especially bigger trucks, although they say they're selling about 9% of the Colorado and GMC Canyon with the diesel engine, the 2.8-liter engine. And then, of course, in the heavy-duty trucks, the 6.6-liter Duramax is pretty strong. Of course, Ford now is going to introduce a diesel in the F-150 pretty soon. They won't say it, but that diesel obviously would go well in their brand-new Expedition. And again, you need to get that extra fuel mileage to keep increasing your CAFE numbers and meet current and future standards.
Did they talk about a take rate for Cruise?
No, they said they would be ecstatic if they got 9% as they do for the smaller pickup trucks. But they're offering the Cruise diesel with either a manual or an automatic for the first time. And if you think about it, these are cars where, you know, you have to the urea has to be refilled every 4,000 miles, and you're going to have salesmen who are going to have a hard time explaining these cars to a mainstream buyer.
Yeah, right.
So they're hoping
miles. That's nothing.
Yeah,
it's probably a little tank.
It's just a fill-up.
I don't think people are going to like that.
Maybe not. And but on the other hand, with the manual, the highway mileage for the Chevy Cruze is 52 mpg.
Right.
So the car's on sale now. It's, I think they said, about $2,800 more in the LT trim level than the LT gas-powered Chevy Cruze. The other interesting question we brought up, who owns the plant? And this will get into one of the subjects I think we might be discussing. It belongs to Adam Opel. And they build the engines in Hungary, on the accounting books at GM, it goes to the cost and the transfer cost of that engine to Chevrolet or any other division, it goes to Adam Opel.
Wow.
So if GM sells Adam Opel to PSA, it'll become a PSA engine, then they'll just be buying them from PSA.
But before we get to that whole thing, I was just wondering, I mean, did you get any sense of whether they think that the ordinary consumer is going to be all that interested in getting a compact car with a diesel from the point of view of, okay, what have we known as compact cars with diesels for the last few years, Volkswagens? Somehow not such a good reputation.
Yeah, they said that they've done rigorous testing, that they've gone out of their way to make sure that they're meeting the emissions standards.
No, but I mean, in terms of consumers, they're...
The engine is now available in the new Chevy Cruze. That very same engine is going into the new Chevy Equinox, which launches later this year. That's going to be the more mainstream choice for most buyers, being a compact SUV. Again, whether a salesman at a Chevy dealership can explain to someone trading in, say, a Malibu, or because people are downsizing one size and then moving up, why that diesel is a good thing, and it won't have the 52 mpg number, obviously, being a heavier sport utility vehicle and being automatic only, I would assume. But, again, it's going to be something of a cafe play. And I really think that it's going to be, it's going to be a niche buyer. I think they're hoping, they're hoping to get, and they've said this more or less, they're hoping to get Volkswagen buyers who will no longer be able to buy a brand-new diesel-powered Volkswagen in North America. They're going to have some cross-shopping maybe with that Mazda CX-5 diesel. So I think they're hoping to get Chevrolet, get a kind of savvy car enthusiast or tech enthusiast to come in and know what he or she is buying and maybe not worry about the fact that you have to fill the
Do you think this will work?
No, I don't.
Well, I mean, to your point, though.
Talking from a sales standpoint in a passenger car, no, I just don't think it's
going to
work.
If it's 5%.
I wish it would.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the last Cruze, the sales numbers were abysmal. Abysmal. Yeah. Diesel Cruzes.
Yeah, yeah. They claim they never had high expectations for that. They just wanted to get it out there. Steve Grisky was quoted in Automobile Magazine speaking to our Jamie Kittman that if they sold, I forgot what the number was, but something on the order of 5,000, why not? He'd be happy as long as they make money on it, but the cost of cleaning up diesel is still pretty expensive, and it's actually more or less comparable to going hybrid on a gas engine. So
this is why I wondered, on
bigger, more expensive trucks or on Mercedes-Benz, it makes sense.
We got to take a quick commercial break here. We got to talk about Opel too. But Carmen, let's give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back.
Can I just finish up the thought? I agree with you that it's not gonna be a big number at all. Maybe 5%, maybe lower, and 5% of a decreasing segment where there's not gonna be any growth in numbers. But it's just kind of interesting that you have Chevrolet, which you think of as this just kind of big mainstream brand that would not go out of its way to sell anything niche-y. Although
they got the Volt,
well, they've got the Chevy Volt, and then they've got the Chevy Bolt coming up. Exactly. So they've introduced a hatchback version of the Cruze in North America for the first time last year, and they're selling a few of those. And now they're going to offer diesel in either the hatchback or the sedan, manual or automatic. You know, if they get again 5,000 a year, will they be happy?
Okay,
maybe, I don't know.
See, but I think I wonder about
this. It's kind of interesting that they're willing to do that.
Okay, but if we look at, like, okay, so you Cruze, Ford Focus, how many years has there been a five-door Focus? Like, forever. So I don't see that as being so much of a breakthrough.
No, the other thing I think about is
a technologically, if you think about it, Chevy doesn't have a Prius-like hybrid, right?
No.
So what do you do? You do something else. They've got this thing in Europe. Okay, we'll bring these engines in and do it that way. And this is why, if you get back to the Ioniq, I mean, if you're going to get this car for $23,000, that is, I mean, it is a well-featured and put-together vehicle.
As Hyundai does. That's their calling card.
And,
value.
You know, you got no sacrifice. You go to the gas station, you know, you put in the gasoline, 4,000 miles go by, put in more gas. I mean, it's just... You're not going to have these compromises you need to make with the diesel.
And I really think the Volkswagen thing with diesels, I'm really a little bit down on diesels myself. I like the fact that you could get into a car like that and go many hundreds of miles, especially in Great Lakes winter without having to refill.
Yeah, but here's the difference.
But we're talking to car guys. I agree. It's a car guy car.
I love the way diesels drive. I don't like the way that hybrids drive. I don't like the way the Prius drives. It's mushy. It's noisy. You get in a diesel, you just touch the accelerator, boom, that thing just goes.
And you can buy it with a manual. But again, I'm talking to car people.
Right.
You know? That's exactly what that is. So I find it interesting, at least that Chevy, a company like that, a brand like that, is willing to, you know, offer a few hundred of these.
Okay, but here's the thing, and this is, I think, a good segue into the whole Opel discussion. Mm-hmm. They're not going to make any money on this diesel. They're selling Opel. They're selling the whole damn company because they can't make any money on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's amazing to see this kind of discipline, if that's what it really is, of, you know, getting rid of a money-losing operation and happily investing in an engine that's not going to make any money.
All right. So let's talk about this for people who are not following this. Okay. Yeah. So here's PSA, the French company.
Peugeot Citroën.
And so the discussion of their buying from General Motors for a number that I don't think we know, Opel.
Yeah, they're still in discussions, apparently.
And they've
been open about it, so the discussions must be far enough along.
So in Europe, PSA has 10.5% of the market, and Opel has 6.3% of the market. And if you put those two together, then the combined company comes in second to Volkswagen, and it goes ahead of Renault, the other French company, which Carlos Tavares used to work at.
That's right.
And he now runs PSA.
That's right.
So I wonder if that isn't a little...
You bet it is. It is.
There's another thing going on here, I think, and I wrote about it this week at automobilemag.com, that Opel is, what was it, the number four brand in Europe overall.
Yeah.
Vauxhall is number two in the UK behind Ford. Vauxhall now has a Brexit problem. And what better time to get rid of Opel Vauxhall? Vauxhall plays
into this. Vauxhall's just a brand, right? I mean, isn't everything's done through
it's just
Opel,
a brand,
right?
It's just a brand, but it has some resonance in the UK, because even though they're all badge engineered, the Vauxhall brand still has some resonance.
But what I'm getting is, if you sell Opel, Vauxhall mm-hmm. goes with it.
Right, right, you know, exactly.
Yeah, it's the same company. Yeah.
Yes, but you had some, you know, they've had some maybe more success in a much smaller market, if you look at the UK market mm-hmm. versus all of the EU or all of Europe, with Vauxhall, and they've only got two assembly plants there for Astra 5-door and Astra Sport Tour, and then one of the commercial vans. So now it just becomes more enticing for GM to unload Opel Vauxhall at this point.
So Opel has 25% of the UK market right now, and PSA has 13% of the UK market right now. So it seems to me that if those two do come together, that suddenly that company is in good shape in the UK, having 28% of the market, 38% of the market.
Yeah.
So that would be pretty good.
But here's my question. Okay, I understand. In fact, I saw a number from Bloomberg. Since 1999, General Motors has lost $20 billion in Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been trying all this improvement. They've cut down the losses. In fact, they thought they were going to break even with Opel last year. Then Brexit happened, and now they go, whoa, that's
all again, to my point, they estimate that they would have broken even. They took a $300 million, $0.3 billion because of don't know the exact rounding, but $0.3 billion charge on loss on Opel Vauxhall because of Brexit.
Yeah, but, okay, Ford, meanwhile, which is a little bit smaller than GM's operations in Europe, has turned it around. Ford posted a $1.2 billion profit in Europe last year. Mm-hmm. Opel, I think, lost $257 million last year. How come Ford got its places in Europe turned around, and GM just seemingly can't figure it out?
GM didn't hire Jim Farley.
Well, Farley gets credit. There's no question.
And,
but
and
I think
Ford has had
Vodell
the focus,
gets a lot of credit, too. And maybe
focus,
even Mullally.
Second or third best-selling model in Europe. I know it's somewhere in the top five. So while they can't give away Focuses here in the U.S., especially with the automatic transmission, in Europe, it does fairly well.
Well, probably sells well, but I don't think they make big money on it.
No, they don't. But trucks as well. And there we're talking
about
vans
say,
and commercial
trucks. I might get these numbers mixed up. I want to say General Motors sold 1.5 million vehicles in Europe last year. Mm-hmm. Opel, Vauxhall, and there's some Cadillacs and Corvettes in there, too. Ford sold about 1.3 million, I think. So they're not too distant apart in size.
Yeah.
Ford manufactures in England, just as General Motors does with Vauxhall.
But I think more manufacturing in England. Ford has more than assembly plants than...
Yeah, no, engine and stamp, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at, how come Ford got it turned around? I mean, if I'm GM, I'm thinking, damn it, we can do the same thing. We don't have to sell this thing called Opel, which, by the way, we rely on for so much engineering.
Yeah.
And so I understand that why they're under pressure. In fact, there's an article out today that one of the reasons that Mary Barra and Dan Ammann are doing it is there's, I think it's called Greenlight Capital, is accumulating GM shares, and they're agitating for a management shakeup because mm-hmm. the stock price isn't performing to this guy's satisfaction. So you dump Opel, and what happened?
Even though
the stock shot up like 8% in one day.
Okay,
Before that, GM stock was doing better than Ford stock, ironically.
But let me ask a more fundamental question. Can a global automotive manufacturer not have presence in Western Europe?
I'd say you have to.
You would think so. I would think so, too, except that now everybody's talking about how you don't need it as long as you have a good presence in China and maybe in India and in some of the other emerging markets. I think it just seems so, I don't know, antithetical to what, you know, what we're used to. GM having owned Opel since the late 1920s in Vauxhall, somewhere around along the same time.
Opel was 31 that they bought it.
31? Okay, 31. And, you know, it's a different world. And, you know, if you you're getting away from both GM and Ford are looking toward a post car purchase world anyhow. So what's that? What does that mean for Europe versus what they're trying to do or what they're expecting to do in the U.S.? I don't know.
Good segue to, speaking of which, $1 billion investment to be made by Ford into a artificial intelligence company, Argo AI. So what do you think about that, John?
Well, look, AI is the hottest thing right now, and especially when you get into autonomous cars, because you can have artificial intelligence writing the code. You have software writing the software. And when you need billions of lines of code, boy, you save a lot of time that way. Another interesting thing is Argus is an Israeli company. I'm starting to see Israel.
No, this is
Argo.
This is,
no, Argo.
Argo.
Argo is based in
Pittsburgh.
Some Carnegie Mellon.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah, so one
and
guy.
And one worked
one for Google,
Google and the other
one
for Uber.
So it was,
okay.
It was Brian Selsky from Google and Peter Randler of Uber. And they
so
founded. And
Ford won't say exactly when, how. It's hard to determine when Argo was formed, but Ford apparently got in the talks to purchase the company last November. And Argo isn't much older than that. And there's only a few people working there so far. And so, it's kind of like I liken this to, the GE commercials where they show some hotshot software designer who
can't
telling his
hammer.
Friends or her friends that that person's working for a high-tech company and, they're expecting some Silicon Valley thing with a funny name. And the guy says, well, I'm working for General Electric. I'm working on locomotives. And so this is kind of like Ford saying, well, the people who are going to design the software to guide our level 4 autonomous cars in 4 years now, that's who these people are. They're going to have people in Pittsburgh where Carnegie Mellon is. You have people in Southeast Michigan, presumably Dearborn, and people in Silicon Valley. They're going to hire the new hires will have a stock option in Argo. They won't say how much they own of Argo, just that it's at least 51%.
Yeah, they're majority shareholder.
Ownership. I think there's something else going on here. They're also saying that at some point after they develop their own software for their own cars, Argo will be willing to sell this to other automakers.
Ford will be willing to sell to
Ford them. Will be, okay.
Argo is not.
I think. You know
so Mark here? Fields is making the point when he's announcing this is like, okay, don't worry, shareholders. We're going to spend a lot of money right now, but at the end of the day, when these guys create what they're calling the virtual driver system, and we have it in our cars, then it'll become a product that we can sell to the other guys.
And you know what it's going to become? It's going to become just like Beta VHS, because you're going to have a number of Ford won't be the only company reaching that point in 2021. If not then, soon thereafter, many of its competitors from Mercedes to GM to Volvo will have their own vehicles with various systems. But, if we're if these are all to exist on the road together and especially in terms of the level 4 Ford cars in a geo-fenced area where you don't control the car at all, where it's all controlled by the car, Ford's not going to be the only one in that geo-fenced area. There'll be a Chevy, and there'll be a Mercedes, and there'll be a Toyota. And how do we can we allow more than one system to talk to each other and determine who goes first around at this intersection?
So you're arguing there's going to be a dominant design in terms of the software, one might make the argument that we live in a world that has iOS and it has the Microsoft operating system, it has Linux.
But when those crash, they don't crash into each other.
No, but I'm just saying that it isn't necessarily the beta VHS where you end up.
Well, I'm getting
one.
In over my head technically here, but I think at some point, and NHTSA certainly is behind.
Well,
hold on,
because remember, this year Cadillac is supposed to pioneer V2V technology, vehicle to vehicle technology. DOT is already taking testimony, if you will, maybe that's not the right word, from automakers and others because they want this technology mandated by 2020. That's how cars are going to talk to each other.
Right.
And it's going to be a standard that every automaker is going to have to meet. So
there will have to be a standard for the software to guide the car and to talk to the other cars.
I think that could be independent. As long as the cars can talk to each other with a common language, I don't think it's then going to matter if what makes them autonomous is a proprietary system.
Well, I don't know. There could be a couple of standards that, obviously there could be variations, but there will still be a certain standard, and who's going to set that standard? Obviously, Ford wants to be the company to set that standard, as does GM, as does Volvo, and so
on. I think it'll be a performance standard, not a hardware or a software standard.
Yeah.
So it'll be a different thing.
Right.
So it'll be basically, look at it this way. If you had a CB radio, you could talk to anybody, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what kind of car it is.
Yeah.
As long as they have a CB radio.
As long as they have a CB radio, all cars will be equipped with CB radios, and they'll all talk, and they'll be happy.
Yeah.
And they'll drive autonomously. It won't be a CB radio.
Right. No, I know that. But, I mean, but the standard for how does the car determine when to emergency stop, because there's a, you know, how do you,
right.
You
again,
handle
but
pedestrians?
That's a process standard, not a hardware standard.
Yeah, because, it's like, with adaptive cruise or forward collision warning today, they all do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's going to happen, to your point, Todd, is that the race is going to be on who can move the geofence posts as far and as wide as possible faster than anyone else.
Yeah.
Because when Ford comes out with its level 4 in 2021, as it says it will, it's only going to be available in given geofenced areas.
Right.
You're only going to be able to use it. So now the race is going to start. Who can start moving those geofence posts more?
Yeah.
To the point where the argument's going to be, my car is more autonomous than your car. Today we say, my car's got more horsepower than your car. In the near future, it's going to be, my car is more autonomous. Come buy my Ford, because it can take you more places than that Chevy, that Hyundai, that Mercedes can.
Yeah, I always thought range was the new horsepower.
Yeah. I'm a little surprised that Fields, when they made this announcement this week, he's still sticking to 2021. I mean, and not backing down from that. Because you think you can sort of like smudge it,
Well, but,
But I know they've got a program. I mean, they're building a purpose-built car to be this ride-sharing. It's not going to be in showrooms. It's going to be fleet-managed ride-sharing car. The program's underway right now as we speak.
Yeah, and you've got some testing going on in Pittsburgh. So all it takes is one or two cities. And certainly look at, it could be around here because Michigan's trying to take the lead in developing autonomous cars. But you've got Silicon Valley as well. And maybe Pittsburgh, where Carnegie Mellon is, and where is it Uber and Volvo
Uber,
testing in Uber cars and with the driver still behind the wheel. But all you need are two or three cities.
Somebody was saying this week, and it's sort of funny, when I mentioned I was out driving this new car, somebody said, "So, when there are autonomous cars, what are we going to do?"
Oh, what are we going to do?
You're going to go on a drive program and talk about the seats?
We're going to be writing about old cars.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and about, the car condo parks like there is up in Pontiac. I mean, that's what it's going to come down to, It's a brave new world, Gary.
Yeah.
Hey, look, we ought to wrap it up, but this has been a very, very good show, very good show. Todd, it's always great having you here.
John, always happy to be here.
Yeah, and let's do it again next week.
Next week.
Okay, and all of you are invited back then.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.